can't help but smile after a song like that. Our opening words today are from the Reverend Susan McGinn. From beyond the playful summer clouds, beyond the earth's thin blue line, from beyond the bright moon and meteor showers, we hear the call to look and listen carefully, to turn away from a world that buys and sells happiness, to fully experience the luring whisper of your heart's truth. Why not today? Why not now? We are here and together at home in this evolving place, home in this ever-changing breath and body, home in this dewy morning, even as it reaches toward a hot high noon. We hear the call from beyond and deep within, and we do not hear it alone. Come, let us worship together. I'd like to invite our Environmental Action Team co-chair, Marion Pate, to light our chalice today.
Welcome. Well, I was kind of amazed when I read the title of Bob Gifford's sermon today, Dragons, Mules, and Honeybees. Because what is kind of amazing is that when I was in Mexico recently, as many of you know, I saw a lot of mules and honeybees and pictures of dragons. And that was especially in a town called Jocotepec. And I thought I'd invite you to say that name, Jocotepec. Got to go right in the back of your throat, Jocotepec. Took me a while to manage that. It is named, it's Tepec means place, and Joco is the name of a tree that grows in that region abundantly. And what I think is really cool is not only is the village named after a tree, the state where the village is located is Oaxaca, and it is named after the Oaxaca tree. So a state, a place with beautiful forests that people have loved for a long time. In the mythology, even, the first people were born of a tree. But the mules, so when I was stayed there, we were staying in a little house right next door to Pedro and Ignacia. And every morning, Ignacia got up bright and early. She got up bright and early, maybe earlier than you get up even. And she would start up her mill. She had a little tiny mill. And she'd take the dried corn that she'd pulled off the cobs the day before and put it through the mill and mix up with water, and that would make masa, tortilla dough. And neighbors would come, and they'd pay her a little bit to run their corn through her little mill, too. And Pedro, he would saddle up his mules. That's where the mules come in. He'd saddle up his mules and go off to the field where he grew the corn that she was using for the tortillas. And he wasn't the only one. Almost all the men in town had mules or donkeys or horses, and off they'd go. Sometimes they'd have big metal milk jugs hanging off the mule, and others had boxes for all the honeybees, because that is what they farm in the area, corn and coffee. They've got lots of cows for dairy and honeybees. So eating there was a real pleasure. It was, once I was there, it was probably a 5-kilometer diet with the corn. The tortillas were made of that local corn and beans grown there with tomatoes and cheese produced right there. It's pretty special. But the coffee may have been grown locally, but it was weak. And I wondered if that's because of the dragons. The dragons in Mixtec mythology are of the wind and the rain, the weather. And the thing is, it seems like the weather's been changing a bit there. Who knows if it is caused by climate change, but the coffee crop has failed completely this year. It's a tragedy for that village. Even the corn is not doing well, Clemente told me. And the rain has been coming in the dry season. So when the bees go to get the honey, the nectar from the flowers, they haven't been so successful. So people in Jocotepec are worried. They're worried because they're thinking, things are changing. Does that mean we have to change our ways? We've been eating tortillas for thousands of years. Change is a hard thing. Is there anybody besides me who's expert at resisting change? bet you are too. So that's an R word. There's the other R word, which is our theme of the month, resilience. And so this is my wish for myself and for all of you and for the people of Hokotepec and everywhere, is to find resilience in this time of change. And so I thought to embody that, as you adults rise to sing us out of the sanctuary, you could have a little bounce, you know, bouncing back, resilience. And I thought we could walk out with a little bounce in our step too, to send out wishes of resilience to the world. So Anna and I are going to lead the way, and let's walk out with resilience.
Earth Mother, Star Mother, you who are called by a thousand names, may all remember we are cells in your body and dance together. You are the grain and the loaf that sustains us each day. And as you are patient with our struggles to learn, so shall we be patient with ourselves and with each other. We are radiant light and sacred dark, the balance. You are the embrace that heartens and the freedom beyond fear. Within you we are born, we grow and live and die. You bring us around the circle to rebirth. Within us you dance forever. Good morning. I want to say a special hello to anyone watching. And I really want to recognize all the people who put their effort into making each Sunday morning possible, that you probably, some of you don't see all the effort that goes into it. I want to recognize all that effort. And I want to send a special greeting out to those of you who have shared this journey with me for something like as long as I have. I'm glad to be here. I like to quote that philosopher Keith Richards, who said, "I'm glad to be anywhere." But I am especially glad to be here. I've been somewhat prodigal the last few years, a practice I wholeheartedly do not recommend. But I have been here in spirit every Sunday. I consider you to be my other family and this building to be my other home. I'll never forget the symbolic walk when this building was opened, when we moved here into this beautiful edifice. Look at this beautiful building from Superior Street. I stand here for the third time and reflect on the ministerial tradition of my own forebears. I hope that my thoughts today may qualify, at least for someone listening, as ministering. However, it is I who am happy, privileged, to be ministered to by many of you, my extended family. As I reach a certain age, I realize that life itself is the greatest gift, the water that we fishes sometimes overlook, the gift without which we would not be able to enjoy those other gifts that we sometimes are fortunate enough to have: good health, a loving family, supportive friends. But anyway, I came here to speak of dragons, mules, and honeybees. Why this eco-menagerie? Importantly for me, how do they relate to this community? I'm sometimes sensitive to my fear that what I do as a social scientist may not have a place in my church. Where's the connection between behavioral science and the ultimate questions we explore here? Is there one at all? Happily, I think we can have a conversation, a rapprochement, between the discourses of science and spirituality, and I'm attempting that today. But first, how important is this problem? The world has a lot of serious problems. But one person whose job it is to face many or even most of those problems in the world recently said this: "There's one issue that will define the contours of this century more dramatically than any other, and that is the urgent and growing threat of a changing climate. This is from that guy, Barack Obama. A more local person recently said this: climate change is the greatest collective challenge that we face as a nation. That's that guy named Justin Trudeau. So this week, I hope shared with you to some extent, was celebrating and savoring a rare moment when the leaders of my two countries, both of whom I believe are trying to do the right thing, both of whom seem like authentic humans, were meeting and embracing. And the cherry on the cake for me was that the first item on their agenda was my own chief scientific concern. But as some less sanguine people said, words, words, words. I hope not. I know that climate change becomes real sometimes when you have a personal experience of it rather than just words, hearing words or speaking words. My own such experience came one day when I was down at the Inner Harbor and kind of gazing out on the water, and I saw sitting on the log a brown pelican. I looked at this brown pelican and I said, wait a minute, this is not, there's something wrong here, or something different here. This bird, last time I saw one, was in Mazatlan in Mexico. So why is this bird here? There's fish here that this bird can eat. Things are warming up. So this kind of personal experience is what really makes something like climate change come home. I stood here last about 7 years ago. Some of you might remember, and I described 13 dragons, a baker's dozen of rationalizations, justifications, or just plain excuses that we, including myself, used to escape doing the right thing for Mother Earth, who gave us our very existence and continues to nourish us today. These fearsome creatures were created in response to journalists who asked me a perfectly reasonable question. If people are so much in favor of the environment, why don't they do more to care for it? Rather than offer a tangled bouquet of obtuse or abstract behavioral science theories as answers, I learned that straightforward answers in plain English, or in nearly plain English, seem to work better. Back in 1954, the science fiction writer Robert Heinlein wrote that people are not rational animals, although they often think they are. Rather, he said, people are rationalizing animals. As we environmental psychologists have framed it in the decades since, there's often a large gap between our words and our actions. In fact, a recent study found that 87% of Canadians feel this gap between their beliefs that the environment needs some help and their own actions. So what I'm talking about today is not at all unusual. As someone once said, okay, it was me, but someone else probably said it too, words will not improve our relations with the environment, no matter how sweet or soulful or poetic or well-intentioned or sincere. Only our actions will change. 7 years ago, I speculated at the end of my remarks that maybe there's more than 13 dragons. Yep, I'm sad to say, those 13 dragons have done what most creatures endeavor to do: multiply. So now there are 37 dragons. Until this week, there was only 36 dragons, but a new one hatched while I was preparing for today. You will be the first to hear about this little terror a bit later. But fortunately for you, don't worry, I'm not going to describe all 37 dragons. However, extensive and intensive research has shown that the 37 dragons fall into seven genera. More about those in a moment. These dragons stand in the way of us doing the things that we should do. But what does should mean? Some of these shoulds are those that other people try to impose on us, and others are shoulds that we have chosen to impose upon ourselves. The external shoulds include lists of things to do. You can find 10 such actions. Al Gore listed them in Inconvenient Truth. If you go on the web, you can find a list of 50 things that you can do. And if you look a little farther on the web, you can find a website that offers you 51 things that you can do. A local environmentalist wrote a book about the 101 things that you can do. But I suspect that each person in this room or watching, hello, already has a personally chosen list of shoulds. And so I'm very aware that, to a large extent, I'm preaching to the converted here today. Still, I suspect that many of us, myself most certainly included, still feel a gap. Although we do already this, and we already do that, and for the environment, and we should do more. But so far, we're not doing more. And I'm not either. So why don't we do more of what we ourselves believe that we should be doing? Dragon genus number one, limited thinking, a.k.a. the hesitation blues. I didn't know that I should do that. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know where to do it. I wasn't sure if it was actually the right thing to do. Are those big, heavy light bulbs with some mercury in them really better than simple old incandescent bulbs? Is hand washing the dishes better than using a dishwasher? When we're not sure, we tend to hesitate. I've heard that message so often that I've stopped paying attention. What can one person do about it anyway? I'm unsure about where and when climate change will strike, and I don't see it around me right now. I guess it's in the future sometime. I'll deal with it when it gets here. Its effects probably won't be felt very much here in Victoria anyway. Oh, don't worry about it. The engineers will fix it, the policymakers, somebody else will fix it. Hesitation blues. Dragon genus number two, ideology. I'm pretty sure I'm not talking to a lot of people in this room here, but for many conservatives, my overall worldview shelters me from this so-called problem. I'm comfortable as things are. Let's not change too much. My lifestyle feels threatened by climate change. A supernatural deity is in control, so my effort isn't really needed. Or the secular version, this is a natural process. Nature is in control, and so, again, my effort isn't really required. Dragon genus number three, other people. I would change, but he won't let me, she won't let me, she teases me, he teases me. I would change, but they aren't changing. So why should I change if they're not changing? Dragon genus number four, investments. Yes, financial investments, but other kinds as well. Having or being stuck with climate negative investments, cars, large houses, but not only financial investments. Habit is another kind of investment. We engage in habits to save ourselves time, to make our life more efficient, to make our life more convenient, so that we can engage in things that we think are more important. But if those habits are climate negative, they're a problem. Here's perhaps the scariest dragon, I think, in this room. Investments in other things. This is a hard one. I'm invested in my health, my work, my children, justice, poverty. Sorry, I just don't have time for climate issues. But I would like to point out that climate is a justice issue. It is a refugee issue. It is a children's issue. It is a health issue. Climate is part of all those other issues. So we just need to connect our dots in this room. Dragon genus number five, discredence. Once again, I think, doesn't apply very much in this room. Mistrust of the government, mistrust of experts, mistrust of scientists. My sense is that policies and programs aimed at climate change are just inadequate, so I'm not going to partake in them. Or I'm afraid I'm going to lose my freedom to what I really want to do if I have to not fly to Costa Rica to look at the butterflies or whatever. Dragon genus number six, fear of risks. We know as psychologists that most people, not all, are risk averse. We're afraid of risk. Change all change involves at least some risk, whether it's in this area or in relationships or in moving, changing jobs. So we shy away in general from taking risks. And if we see climate change as a kind of risk or the behaviors that we have to engage in to mitigate it as a risk, then we hesitate a bit. Dragon genus number 7, the last one, limited change. I usually sum up this in 2 sentences, and I hope you can get the rest by analogy. I recycle, so I'm done. Thank you very much. Recycling is a good thing, but it's not going to do it by itself. But my favorite one is, honey, I bought a Prius. Let's drive across Canada. I think you get the idea there. So those are the main reasons, justifications, excuses, dragons. Oh, yes, I promised you that you would be the first to hear about dragon number 37. It's not a new idea, but it is new to my eco-menagerie. Dragon 37 is, en français, après moi le déluge. After me the flood. This quote has been attributed to King Louis XV in France, or some people say to Madame Pompadour. But basically it means, you know, there's no hope. It's all over already. Armageddon is coming anyway. I don't care. I can't care. There's no point. This kind of fatalism is real in some people. And of course, it's a dragon for engaging in any further action. This little hatchling is very bad guy. He's going to grow up as a bad guy. So that's the dragons. But you might be asking, what about this eco-menagerie you were talking about? What about mules? What about honeybees? Well, mules, they have a bad image for some people. Stubborn, maybe not the brightest bulb on the farm. But I happen to love mules, and I go hug them every fall when I can at the Saanich Fair. So I made mules the heroes of my eco-menagerie, because they, especially pack mules especially, carry the load. So the mules are those of you and those in other places who might have a dragon or two nipping at your heels, but are already doing virtually everything that you possibly can for the climate and for the environment. I salute you, mules. Honeybees? What do they do? Well, the real honeybees pollinate trees and flowers. And are they doing it to give us humans food? Not really, no. They do it for the benefit of themselves and their own hives. But we humans do benefit from their work, as best they can do with pesticides out there. We benefit from their self-interested pollinating. So what does that have to do with the eco-menagerie? The eco-menagerie honeybee is the person who does the right thing for the environment, but not for environmental reasons. He cycles for health, even though he's a climate denier. She adds insulation to her house, but she's only doing it to save money. So is that a bad thing? No, it's not a bad thing at all. It's actions that count, not words. Here's some food for thought, though, that gives me pause. One expert has calculated that honeybees, as a whole, do more for the environment and for the climate than mules do. It's too bad, but it seems to be true. Just as in the real world, there are a lot more eco-menagerie honeybees than there are eco-menagerie mules. Maybe we can change that. At the beginning, I said I was a little bit concerned about connecting the dots between what I do at work and what we do here. So I did try to find some bases for connecting climate and the ultimate kinds of questions we ponder in this beautiful space. Here's what I found. The Lord God took the man, and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. This is Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. Certainly the basis for the stewardship tradition in Christianity. And it sounds to me like this is the reason we should take care of the planet. Unfortunately, as often happens in that Bible, there's something else lurking on another page. It happens to be Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Whoa. This has to be the philosophical basis for the kind of exploitation that we see today. Fortunately, the Bible redeems itself a little bit later in the book of Galatians with a warning. "Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." That's in Galatians. Now, that probably is meant in an interpersonal kind of way, but I choose to interpret this to be similar to the Hindu concept of karma extended to our treatment of the environment. Doing awful things to the environment may well lead to a very serious pushback from the environment, and we're seeing some of that already. This could also be extended to the more positively phrased admonition one finds in various forms in many traditions: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And again, if we think of the other you as being the environment, what if the other is Mother Earth and not just another person? As for Islam, one can read in the Quran, "Eat and drink, but waste not by excess, for Allah loveth not the wasters." Finally, Buddhism, as represented by the Dalai Lama. If we exploit the natural environment in an extreme way, today we benefit, but in the long run, we ourselves will suffer, and future generations will suffer. So, what can we do? I think each of us faces a different set of barriers or dragons. So for me, step one is a kind of self-diagnosis. Change is difficult. What's the easiest thing to change for you? Diet? Transport? Energy use? Divestment? Forgoing unnecessary purchases? Pick your own low-hanging fruit. Pick an important action, but pick one that is feasible for you. Step two, then, of course, is actively seeking ways to overcome the barriers to that. Learn how to accomplish it. Then, one good strategy, I think, is to use social pressure in your favor. Make your goal known to someone who will gently push you, and ask that someone for his goals, for her goals, and drag each other along when the going gets tough. And finally, reward yourself in some small, but not climate negative, way for your progress. In closing, I'd like to offer you some words from those on whose traditional territory we are gathered today. Chief Dan George said, "We are only as much alive as we keep the earth alive." A quote from the Assembly of First Nations is like this: "If we listen from the place of connection to the spirit that lives in all things, Mother Earth will teach us what we need to know to take care of her and all her children." So finally, I urge you, as I urge myself, take one more step toward muledom. Thank you.
So our closing words today are from the writing of Unitarian Universalist Eric Williams. "May the firmness of the earth be yours. May the flow of the water be yours. May the freedom of the air be yours. May the fierceness of the fire be yours. May all the gifts of this life, the below and the above, be with you now and remain with you always." And I've added, "And may the mules and honeybees within you join together to slay those dragons." Okay. Thank you.